The Bible study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
All right, it's hour number two. This will be the embarrassing hour. Pastor Parvey didn't know that, but he knows it now.
I do. We're not going to be embarrassed about.
Our numbers are 505-785-1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment here on Ask the Pastor. I just found out that Pastor Parviz is not just a pastor, but he is an executive director. He's got a big, long title. What's your title?
Executive director.
Of
Lutherans and Jewish Evangelism.
Lutherans and Jewish Evangelism. That sounds oxymoronic to me.
It does. You should see the website. It actually says I'm an oxymoron.
Does it really?
Yes, it does.
I have to check that out here. I'll bring that up if I get a chance. So I always knew that you had an affiliation, but I didn't know you were the CEO.
Yeah, well, I'm the big cheese.
We're going to get to that.
The big Gouda.
That's exactly where we're headed.
Oh, is it?
The big cheese. So tell me about the organization. Somebody listening to us and never even heard of it. Describe it for me.
That's a mission society of our church body, a recognized service organization that was founded in 1981 by Reverend Bruce Leeske, who was then a pastor in Philadelphia. He was the guy that initiated the first synodical resolution in 1973 to begin Jewish missions in our church body. And from 1973 to 1981...
Was he Jewish?
He was not. That's the blessing of this organization is, 80% of Jewish people who come to faith in Jesus do so by the testimony of their Gentile friends. And I always tell people, I'm a terrible missionary. The Jews, because I'm Jewish, the Jews typically write me off as a traitor to my people.
Yeah.
But they respect you for your faith. And I'm really good on the back end after we have these conversations and people have started to become a little softer to the concept. And so my ministry is to help train non-Jewish people in around our church body to help share their faith with Jewish people. And I think that's, if Jewish missions depends on Jewish pastors, there's like three in our church body that I can think of. So, it's just not going to happen. So I really am blessed by Reverend Leeske's commitment to the Jewish people. And he's currently retired. He runs our Orlando branch. We have branches in Orlando, Miami, Detroit, and St. Louis. And hopefully in the fall we'll have a branch in Atlanta. So,
how do you balance pastoring a congregation and managing the affairs of this organization?
It is a challenge. Fortunately, the congregation is along with the King of Kings Lutheran Church in Chesterfield, is sort of the base of the branch here in St. Louis. So in many ways, much of what I do does have crossover, but it is a challenge. One of the challenges, of course, is that as executive director of Elijah, which is what we call our organization, online it's Elijah. It does cause me to go out and have to speak in churches. Not have to, but I love doing that. But it does take away from the pulpit at Havah Shalom, and so. Yeah, it's a balancing act. I have a dear friend who's a retired pastor who fills my pulpit for me very ably. And we have a deacon who's very good at leading worship. So
do you accept donations?
Certainly. We are a faith ministry.
Would I, a Gentile Christian all my life, want to give money to your organization when you just said, pretty much, and have said before, about the hardest nut to crack in the whole world?
It is true.
Is to bring somebody who is Jewish to Jesus.
Well, my gut response to that would be because you love the Lord and you love the Scriptures, and St. Paul wrote in the book of Romans that the gospel is the power of salvation for everyone who will believe, first to the Jew and then to the Gentile. I really do believe that if the church has Jewish missions, even a small bit, set aside for Jewish missions first, the rest of the missions will follow. And if you look at even St. Paul, he was the apostle to the Gentiles, and yet everywhere he went first to the synagogue, he went first to the Jew. His missiological methodology, if you will.
Missiological methodology.
His, the way in which he did missions.
I'm going to start taking notes here. All right.
The way in which he did his mission seems to me a guide and way in which we should do our mission. So we should not forget that first mission of Jesus and first mission of the church.
All right, let's talk about that big cheese stuff here in just a second. But our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk to Bill. Hi, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Yes, good morning to both of you. I guess I'm going to be a rat now after the cheese, I guess.
Well, it depends on your question, sir.
I can see it coming, though.
Okay. I was, baptized as an infant, and I was raised in the Lutheran Church, was confirmed, and everything else. Now, later in life, I got away from the Lutheran Church, and I got mixed with different religious groups, and one of them was the Seventh-day Adventist.
Mm-hmm.
And affiliated groups. There was kind of a group I was kind of interested in for a short, very short time, Seventh Church of God Seventh-day, which was kind of not really strong, but I was actually a Seventh-day Adventist for a while. The question is, is there a good way, you yourself, with your personal experiences, did you ever witness to a Seventh-day Adventist? And here's the reason why I ask. They make a very strong point that since the worshiping on the Sabbath, which they always believe, of course, was Saturday, and they use argumentations for the fact that the early church changed the day to Sunday, and they quote the popes and things that they changed the times and the seasons, which they take out of parts of the Bible, maybe out of Daniel or Revelation or something, that that the church became apostatized.
Right.
So therefore, they use the argument that since it's in the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments themselves were not abrogated at the cross. They were not nailed to the cross.
Hey, Bill, do they impose circumcision? Do you have to be circumcised to be a Seventh-day Adventist?
You know, I don't remember them ever talking about that, although they were kind of strong with the dietary things, but they wanted to kind of get people to kind of turn away from eating even milk and dairy products and coffees and things.
How about sacrificing bulls and goats and lambs? Do they do that?
Yeah. You know, they didn't, you know, there was never talk about that, but I was just wondering, the argumentation would be more or less the fact that it's actually in the Ten Commandments about honoring the Sabbath day, and they argue that the church, early church, changed that. I know the way I feel about it, but how would you handle
sure,
that?
Sure, we'll talk about it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Goodbye.
Well?
Yeah, of course I run into this all the time because there's lots of, you don't have to be Seventh-day Adventist.
You run into it all the time?
All the time. You don't have to be a Seventh-day Adventist to be a Sabbatarian. In fact, our congregation first worshipped on Saturday morning. And just so you know, Bill, even the church will still maintain that the Sabbath is Friday night sundown to Saturday night sundown. And the early church did not change the Sabbath. The early church also worshipped on the first day of the week. What was generally going on the Sabbath was that the Jewish people were worshipping in the synagogue who were also believers. And they were also getting together on the first day of the week, as is evidenced by some of Paul's writings, to honor the day of the resurrection. And Paul said on the first day of the week, when you gather together, take an offering for the work of the saints, things like that. So we thought missiologically it would be appropriate to worship on the Sabbath, as well as practically it was very practical because we were sharing space at that time at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, and they were pretty busy on Sunday morning. But we discovered pretty quickly, I think at our fifth anniversary, we realized that as a congregation of God's people, in order to grow, we needed to move to Sunday morning. And we still had Friday night Shabbat observations for our missiological purposes. And we found out there were people in our own church who felt this really need to worship on the Sabbath, that it was required, and that any time you worshiped on Sunday, you were somehow apostate. And so we had sort of our first little church split, if you will, at that point in our time when we moved to Sundays. And we, you know, there's also Messianic groups that insist upon Saturday worship and things like that. And I guess the way I talk about it with a lot of people is, number one, the function of the Sabbath originally was that God would that we would recognize, and this is very clear in the Torah, that the purpose of Sabbath is for us to rest and recognize God's creative power, that in 6 days he created the heavens and the earth. So one of the biggest apostate violations of the Sabbath, frankly, is to be an evolutionist. And if you are a Christian who subscribes to evolution, you are essentially breaking the Sabbath, because the whole point of Sabbath was to recognize God's creative power. And it didn't really get mixed up with worship until the Babylonian captivity, when the synagogue system started and they started to equate Sabbath with worship. And so it really was never intended to be a worship day. It was intended to be a day in which we would rest and reflect upon God's creation and to recognize his creative power and that he created the world in 6 days. That was the original intent of the Sabbath. And it didn't change. It hasn't changed even today. And I think we can do that. Of course, the rabbis, I think in some sense, I think of the wilderness wanderings of the Israelites as God dealing with 2-year-old children. They had been slaves in Egypt, had never had a day of rest. They had to be actually required to take a day off and rest because it was not in their habit. And it's something, I think, akin to us who are parents. When we have a stovetop and a 2-year-old child, we tell that child, no, don't touch. We know they're not responsible enough to handle the responsibilities of a stove, and they'll burn themselves. And that's what God was doing with the Israelites in the wilderness. And as we mature in our faith, just like our 2-year-old who grows up, we say, by all means, touch the stove. Here's how you use it. You have the freedom now to use it. Make my dinner. And I think God does that to us, too. He gives us this freedom now that we've matured in our faith to understand what the law is about. And that's what Jesus was talking about when he said that Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so it is, and this is one of the frequently asked questions that I try to respond to on our website as well. I don't think that part is published yet, but it is a conundrum that a lot of people seem to get hung up with. And Seventh-day Adventists are the same.
We just finished studying Acts chapter 15. We moved into Acts 16 today. And it seems to me that the main question of the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15, must you be circumcised in order to be saved? And, of course, the Old Testament law is clear. You have to circumcise all the baby boys. Or if you come into the faith later, that's what you have to do. You have to be circumcised. And the Jerusalem Council said no. Now, when Seventh-day Adventists 2,000 years later come along and say you have to worship on Saturday, are they in some way missing Acts chapter 15?
Well, I think they're still, in a sense, immature in their faith and feeling a need to have these fences around them without being able to explore the freedom that obviously the first church in Jerusalem was figuring out in the wake of Jesus' death and resurrection. And so that's, I think that, in many ways they lose Acts chapter 15. People ask me when I go visit people in their homes. I stay with pastors when I go to guest preach in churches around the country. And they will say, well, are you kosher? Because, of course, they're concerned. What are they going to feed this guy who's coming in? And I always say, I saw the sheet. I don't have a problem with what you have to feed me. Just don't give me soy products. But although I'm coming to like tofu. But you get my gist. Yeah, there's a freedom that I think we're really afraid to exercise. And in some sense, in our fear, we really feel like we want these boundaries and these laws so that we can feel like we're worshiping God properly, when in fact God gives us the freedom and the joy to worship him. And that's what the Holy Spirit is for, is to inform and to give us that freedom to worship God properly.
Well, we have examples all over the place now. We have tofu, we have big cheese.
Clearly, I'm hungry today. So,
I'm on a story from Christian Newswire here. I find it fascinating that when the church has something to say to the culture or the civil realm,
There are no shortage of folks who hold up their hands. So they give you the stop sign. They, oh, no. Don't be bringing that church state over here. We have a separation of church and state, and we don't want to hear what your contrived restrictions are, restraints on my freedom. I want to be able to do pretty much whatever I want to do. But then it's not always true in the reverse.
Right.
The culture sometimes invades the church realm, co-opts a couple of things in order to make a civil or cultural point. So I found this fascinating. I thought you and I, being larger than life like we are, and not fans of tofu, maybe could talk about this. The story is headlined, "The Largest Last Supper." And then it says, "Portion Distortion Throughout the Millennium." It begins with a question. Were the 12 apostles guilty of overeating at the Last Supper? Two brothers, an eating behavior expert and a religious studies scholar, are publishing findings that might make you think twice at your Easter dinner. Brian and Craig Wansink teamed up to analyze the amount of food depicted in 52 of the best-known paintings of the Last Supper. After indexing the size of the foods by the sizes of the average disciple's head, they found that portion size, plate size, and bread size increased dramatically over the last 1,000 years. Overall, the main courses depicted in the paintings grew by 69%, Pastor. Plate size by 66% and bread size by 23%. The study's findings are published in the April 2010 issue of the International Journal of Obesity. Here's a quote. "I think people assume that increased serving sizes or portion distortion is a recent phenomenon." That came from Brian Wansink, who is professor and director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. "But this research indicates that it is a general trend for at least the last millennium. As the most famously depicted dinner of all time, the Last Supper is ideally suited for review," said Craig Wansink, professor of religious studies at Virginia Wesleyan College. "The method we use created a natural crossroads between our two divergent fields and a wonderful opportunity to collaborate with my brother." So here are some people whose agenda, I think, is clear because they're writing for the International Journal of Obesity. And have decided...
They probably got a federal grant for this study.
I don't even want to go
there.
Oh,
gosh. I can't
believe... And so they study 52 artist depictions, since there aren't any photographs, from the Last Supper. And they notice that portion size is increasing. Of course, they want us to be... They all want us to weigh less. And so they have captured religious art in order to support their argument.
And of course, this will be a wonderful support for our new health care reform.
What do you make of this?
Us for obesity. Well, you know, this is the silliest thing I've ever heard. I have a hard time believing that people actually spend time thinking about this. Because, of course, number one, paintings depicting the Last Supper are horribly, more often than not, not very realistic. I mean, I'm always amazed when I look at Da Vinci's Last Supper, which is, of course, the most famous, and the bread on the table is this nice loaf of white, fluffy bread. There's no leaven at Passover. There's no fluffy bread at Passover. It just amazes me. But I'll have to say categorically that there probably was a lot of food at the Last Supper. Jewish people like to eat. There's a seven-course meal in the middle of the Passover Seder that, they probably had gefilte fish. Well, maybe not. But
what kind of fish?
Gefilte fish. It's a lovely concoction of white fish and carp and spices all ground together and packed in jelly. It's an acquired taste. But it's good with horseradish.
Oh, all right.
But, you know, it's silly to even spend time thinking about this. But, yes, I would venture to guess that there was a large meal at the Passover Seder. It's a celebration. It's a family meal. It is... I mean, these people spend a lot of time to prepare this meal, and you can see that by the fact that after the supper, they went out to the garden, and they couldn't stay awake. They had had so much food. They were falling asleep. So it's just a silly thing. I do enjoy my... And we're having our Passover Seder Sunday afternoon. And we have about 100 guests coming, and we're going to have a large meal. So, you have to take your own responsibility for obesity. It's not going to be how much food I feed you.
Well,
I'm always amazed at these people who go to McDonald's and they don't think they're going to get fat.
I saw a woman here on a cable program here. Oh, it's probably been a couple months ago now. And I don't know if she reads this International Journal of Obesity, but she was affiliated with a group, a movement, which is designed to eliminate obesity from our country. So we fat people, we got to look out because they're on the way.
Did you just call me fat?
No.
I'm glad this is radio.
That's speaking myself. But she made an interesting remark that when, and this preceded health care, that when health care comes, when federal health care comes, you people who are out there eating too much, consuming too much salt, and weighing too much, we're not going to be able to allow that, because the rest of us are going to have to pay for your heart surgeries and your heart bypasses and your stomach stapling and all that. And you know what? We're not going to do that. So you need to get your act together and get down to the weight that you need to be.
And therein lies the problem. Personal liberties are no longer available in this country, and they come with personal responsibility.
So here are a couple of guys, a couple of brothers. See, I'm connecting some dots here. It can always be dangerous, you know. If you go from dot 2 to dot 6, then your picture's not going to be very clear. Mm-hmm. But I'm connecting some dots here. Here are some guys. Brian Wansink wrote a book. The book is Mindless Eating: Why We Eat More Than We Think. And he explores the hidden cues that determine what, when, and how much we eat. Craig Wansink, the brother, specializes in New Testament studies and is the author of Chained in Christ, The Experience and Rhetoric of Paul's Imprisonments. So, I don't know, maybe the two brothers think that we're imprisoned by our mindless eating. And
I think they were probably together at a large family dinner, and they came up with this wild hair just to make a little money, if you want to know the truth.
They did. Here are the statistics. Let me go over them again. The courses depicted in the paintings grew by 69%.
Yeah,
that's more than half. And that's why some of us are too fat, Pastor, because
some artist painted a large meal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's got to be it. I guess I'm not responsible enough for my own health.
I sense that you might be inclined to just, you know, roll your eyes and brush this off. But I don't think we can afford to do that. I think it may be in our lifetimes that the food police arrive. What do you think?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. If I'm rolling my eyes, it's because I'm not sure there's a whole lot I can do about that. And I just am always floored at the things that government, research grants, people come up with that essentially are another step at taking away personal liberty. And that's happening in our country. And I saw the food police happen when they required McDonald's to start putting caloric content on. Anybody who goes to McDonald's and doesn't think they're going to eat that food regularly and get fat is just an idiot. And now we have to inform the public, and so that who's going to look at those caloric contents? But it's another government study and another government grant in which our money is getting doled out for idiotic things.
Well, these guys have captured religious art. Anytime you move across the line into religion and tap that, it strikes me that you are trying to use the religious, the supernatural, maybe even the Bible, maybe even the Last Supper
to justify
your argument.
Yeah.
It's not a church-state violation, but isn't that kind of an unethical play?
I think that, you know, we can't go the other way. There's no question about that. We're not allowed to use the Bible to justify our positions with regard to society. So it's clearly unethical, especially if, in fact, and I'm only guessing that this too got a federal grant for this, but if that happened, I'd be interested in checking that out.
You're listening to our Ask the Pastor Bible Study. Pastor Kevin Parviz is here with us today. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-27. What do you think? Is the overweight Chuck making much ado out of nothing? Let us know.
Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, will host Brunch at the Sim on Easter Sunday, April 4th, and on Mother's Day, May 9th, in Coburg Hall on the seminary campus. Brunch will be served from 10 until 3. The menu includes carved ham, fried chicken, carved roasted turkey, jumbo cocktail shrimp, eggs benedict, and even Belgian waffles. Reservations are recommended for Concordia Seminary's Brunch at the Sim.
On the next adventure in Odyssey, mystery is afoot when Barrett's favorite video game goes missing.
You hear me? It's gone!
It sounds like a job for...
the Jones and Parker Detective Agency. Mystery is our middle name.
And solving the case may be more difficult than it seems.
Did the ants carry it down inside their little anthill?
Solve the mystery for yourself on the next Adventures in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on KFUO Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Here's a wonderful example of God unfolding His plan. An Indianapolis woman saw her kids off to school and then realized she was late for an abortion at Planned Parenthood. She called to see if she could still come in. In her haste, she dialed the wrong number and got someone with 40 days for life. It's a group that has a prayerful presence outside the abortion mill. The mother of four with a husband in jail had reason to think abortion was her answer, but now she's getting the help she needs. A pro-life counselor helped her choose life for her baby. Volunteers came up with money for her electricity bill and rent. Others are working to help her find a job. It's an example of how God wants us to put our faith into action.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Offense and defense. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. The Vatican is defending its decision not to defrock an American priest who's accused of molesting about 200 deaf boys in Wisconsin. Church and Vatican documents show that in the mid-1990s, two Wisconsin bishops urged a Vatican office to let them hold a church trial against the Reverend Lawrence Murphy. The Vatican office was led by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who's now Pope Benedict. The daughter of one of those deaf students says,
"The Pope knew about this. He was the one who handled the sex abuse cases. So I think he should be accountable because he did nothing."
Vatican officials say there was no cover-up in the Murphy case and are denouncing what they say is a campaign to smear Pope Benedict. The Crystal Cathedral has told vendors who supplied live animals and costumes for its Christmas pageant that it can't afford to pay them. The California megachurch is $55 million in debt and has had major layoffs this year. I'm Steve Coleman.
Peace Lutheran Church in Lime has long been an enthusiastic supporter of radio ministry through their live worship broadcasts on Sunday morning and midweek during Lent. Pastor Dennis Castens and the congregation of Peace Lutheran Church invite you to listen on Saturday night at 5 p.m. as well. Saturday evening worship is often a more relaxed and casual style of service, which many people find beneficial. Feel free to tune in Saturdays at 5 p.m. live worship from Peace Lutheran Church on KFUO Radio.
The Apostle Paul once wrote, "Make the most of the time, for the days are evil." It's a sinful world out there. So question, are you making the most of every moment to tell another person about Jesus Christ as the remedy for sin? Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson, inviting you to tune in to this Sunday's Moments of Assurance and hear all about that blessed remedy. That's Moments of Assurance Sunday at 9:15 a.m. right here on KFUO Radio.
You're listening to the Bible Study. It's an Ask the Pastor Hour of Pastor Kevin Parviz. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. All right, I want to turn my attention here to Holy Week. We're on the verge of Palm Sunday. You've described your congregation, Kyvie Shalom, in ways that for some people listening to us, they say, well, they did what? They used to only worship on Saturday? What are they talking about there? So for you as a person who was raised Jewish, converted to Christianity, now a Lutheran pastor, pastoring a church, which doesn't sound very Lutheran, Kyvie Shalom, that sure doesn't sound like Trinity or St. John. Do you do a radically different Holy Week there, or is it a somewhat different Holy Week, or how does it work?
I think you'd find our Holy Week celebration to be fairly traditional, to be honest with you. We are a congregation of people who have as its core value outreach to the Jewish community, and secondarily to teach our own church about our own Jewish roots. And so we celebrate both the historical church calendar as well as the historical Jewish festival calendar the same. The only thing that's going to be different is, as those things meld, we have, for example, this week, Palm Sunday will be a fairly traditional Palm Sunday worship service, followed by our Passover Seder. That's how we, every Palm Sunday we have our Passover Seder. And we have, our Monday Thursday service will be fairly traditional, apart from the fact that we will be setting the words of the institution within, as we always do every Sunday, the context of the Passover Seder. And so there's this kind of, we sort of see it as, how would the first century church, and we can't possibly know that, but how would the first century church have worshipped on these days, especially following Pentecost? And so we have some Hebrew in our worship service. Our service is, if you were to come and visit with us, well, we might think it's traditional. You probably think it was different. We have the Shema in every service, which is the Hebrew prayer that begins our worship service following the invocation. So there are those kinds of differences, but we think of them as pretty traditional.
I guess there's no way to know, but if we could sort of take what you do in worship at Kyvie Shalom and set it up there on the table and take a look at it, and then take traditional American Christian worship, which admittedly comes in a variety of forms. Let's just talk about traditional mainline. Put it up on the table. Put the two side by side. Which do you think more closely resembles what was going on in the first century?
Again, I'd like to say it's what we're doing, because that's what we're trying to do. Is try to kind of give an approximation of how the prevailing Jewish church would have been worshiping in the first century and following, until, of course, the church became largely non-Jewish. So I would think it would be us. I suppose you would find our Sunday morning Easter service a bit untraditional, in that most churches are standing room only on Easter. Ours isn't severely affected by Easter, mostly because we don't have services other than a sunrise service. And if you want to come to services at sunrise when they discovered the empty tomb, that's what we want to do. But I think that, I hope you would find that ours is perhaps more authentic, but who knows what authentic is.
Suppose I'm listening to the Bible study conversation with Pastor Kevin Parviz, and I have a friend, fairly close friend in the workplace, who's Jewish, lives here in St. Louis, could certainly get to Kyvie Shalom if he or she wanted to do it. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, wonder if I had to suggest that candidate A go check it out. Oh boy, that might just open a can of worms that I could never get closed. That might be Pandora's box. Do you want people to do that in the workplace? Maybe, and I'm not saying go proselytize in your workplace, but with your friends and acquaintances, you want Christian people to say to their Jewish friends, you ought to talk to Pastor Kevin Parviz. Is that
yes.
a good idea?
Actually, yes. But not to come to church. You know, frankly, I think church is for believers, and it's not the best place to invite a person who's not of faith. I would say bring them with you to things like our Passover Seder, our Purim party, our Shabbat fellowships. We have lots of activities outside of our divine worship service where you could bring your Jewish friends to come and experience what experience the gospel in a way perhaps they've never experienced it before, contextualize in a way that they've perhaps never experienced it before. Church is not the best place to bring unbelieving visitors. They're by nature, you know, strangers in a strange land. But there's lots of opportunities, and I would love the opportunity just to sit down and have coffee with you at a Starbucks somewhere, you and your friend and me. Sit down and just chat. Give me a call. I would love to set that up with
you. What's the number?
314-645-4456.
All right, I'm going to change the subject here.
All right.
Is that right? I have a story out of Washington. This is how... Do you ever try to unscramble eggs, Pastor?
It's difficult.
Get them back in the shell after they've been all whipped
it's
and beaten.
Too late.
Yeah. Here's a story out of Washington. It says, an evolutionary geneticist and philosopher has won this year's $1.5 million Templeton Prize for affirming life's spiritual dimension. Francisco Ayala, a former priest, has written 30 books explaining evolution and refuting its critics. He recently visited the Creation Museum in Kentucky and called its biblical displays ridiculous. And he argues that nature's defects are better explained by unguided evolution than intelligent design. But Ayala says religion can explain life's meaning and how people should relate to each other and the natural world, while science only explains how things work. The 76-year-old Ayala is a U.S. citizen originally from Spain. Past winners of the Templeton Prize include physicists, cosmologists, and Mother Teresa and Billy Graham. So it seems like from time to time we talk about Christians, believing Christians, Bible-believing Christians, who have somehow imported or made room in their faith system for evolution. We've spent a lot of time talking about that here on our radio station. Sure. Here we have a guy who was a priest, who's not a priest anymore, who identifies himself as a philosopher. So he sounds
quite, all of us philosophers,
quite secular to me. Mm-hmm. But he's made a little room for you in his life, Pastor Parviz. He's made a little bit of room for spirituality and has refused to just completely close the door on religion or the supernatural. What are your thoughts as you consider the now $1.5 million richer Mr. Ayala?
You know, I think that science has long been trying to mesh itself with the spiritual. I mean, most doctors who don't believe at all in God, I'm not saying that most doctors don't believe in God, the doctors who I know who would say they don't believe in God still affirm the power of prayer.
Really?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, I'm sure that they would argue.
You don't believe in God? Well, who are you praying to? Man?
I'm sure that they would say that it's a great psychological benefit to you. It puts you in a good frame of mind, helps your body to heal itself, lessens your stress, all kinds of issues like that. And there's always been this kind of attempt to measure the psychological benefits of spirituality, whether or not there's anything behind them or not. And I think that's what Ayala is doing himself, is simply saying, well, I mean, he's obviously, as we said at the top of the hour, he's breaking the commandment of keeping the Lord's Day holy. He's an evolutionist, so he obviously doesn't care about Sabbath. He doesn't care about the Ten Commandments. He obviously probably doesn't care that much about God, but finds that spirituality to be perfectly acceptable and even beneficial. And again, those who make those kinds of arguments outside of faith would say it's because psychologically we've put ourselves in a better place when we think there's something out there larger than us. It becomes really, again, we said even oxymoron at the top of the hour. That becomes an oxymoron because one would think that if we put ourselves in a better place as long as we think there's something bigger than us, then why aren't we in a better place when there is somebody bigger than us?
He says, religion can explain life's meaning and how people should relate to each other and the natural world.
Yeah, not with God or...
Yeah, what does that mean, do you think?
Well, you know, we all, that the higher order question, what are we doing here? What is my purpose on earth? You know, religion gives us some kind of, probably in his perspective, fraudulent but yet satisfying answer to that question. And notice he said responding to one another and to nature, not to anything outside of this, you know, nothing supernatural in his statement. It's just a good, it's the old argument that religion is a good evolutionary development in the development of man because it forces a morality upon us that allows us to live together in society.
Well, this is a head scratcher for me. I'm having trouble sorting this out because obviously the man is a scientist. He's written 30 books.
Now, is he a scientist? What are his qualifications?
He's described as an evolutionary geneticist.
Oh, okay.
So if you're a geneticist,
he must be a scientist. Yeah.
I'm assuming that you have a fine scientific background. It would appear that as a scientist, that he has left the door open for religion, for if nothing else, the purpose of explaining life's meaning and how people should relate to other people
and
to the natural world. But if you affirm that there is no God, then what you're saying is if you want to be deceived, if you want to be a fool, if that provides some kind of benefit for you so that you can relate better to people, go ahead.
That's exactly what he's
now,
saying.
I can see some people saying that, but not scientists. It seems to me that scientists, that is the bastion of the facts and only the facts.
Well, certainly Richard Dawkins would not agree with him, yeah.
How do you mean?
Well, he's an absolute atheist and maintains there is nothing supernatural and that you are a fool if you believe these things. And what this fellow Ayala is doing is essentially affirming that it's okay. I think he's essentially trying to reconcile his former life as a priest and having fallen away from faith, apparently, with this newfound foolishness of the health benefits of false spirituality.
Well, whatever he did, he got
$1.5 million. That's a lot like getting the Nobel Peace Prize for having good intentions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not going to go there. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Ms. Harris. You're on the Bible study.
Oh, hi, Pastor and Chuck. I have a question for the pastor.
Sure.
Concerning Gentiles and Jews. We were studying before you came on Acts 15. And I know that there was there's a stark difference between what the Jews believe and, you know, Christians of today and Gentiles of, earlier in the Bible. And I was just reading Acts 15, 8, 9, verse 8 through 9, where it says, God who knows the heart showed that he accepted them by giving the Holy Spirit to them, just as he did to us. He made no distinction between us and them, for he purified their hearts by faith. And I'm thinking, just because I was listening to Chuck earlier and he was saying that mixing of the races is acceptable now, and I think sometimes we get a little mixed up because something is pervasive, we think that it is acceptable, and a lot of things are not acceptable to all people. For instance, illicit sex in the 60s was pervasive, but I don't think it was acceptable by everyone. And just like nowadays, we have the pornography, the drugs, the rap music. It's pervasive, but it's not acceptable. And back in the Bible, I don't think that Christians, Jewish people, were that accepting of Christian people and Gentiles.
Okay. So
and don't be embarrassed. This is not the embarrassing hour. Be not embarrassed.
So I want to make sure, did you have a question in there somewhere or just a comment?
The question is, The question that was put before the consul, must a Gentile become a Jew before he or she can become a Christian? And the question is pertaining to that.
All right. Let's see if Pastor has anything. Oop, there she goes. Any reaction?
Well, I mean, certainly Ms. Harris's question begs a further question, I think. And it has to do with these distinctions, Jews and Gentiles. And I'm guilty of making such distinctions for the sake of clarity with regard to ethnicity. But to be perfectly honest, I really don't like those distinctions. We are told in the scriptures there is no longer Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. In Christ, we are all one. And so, I'm often asked when I talk to people in the Messianic community, they'll say, well, how many Jewish people are in your congregation? And I always say all of them, even though probably half of our congregation is ethnically non-Jewish. By virtue of their faith, they have been adopted into the family of Abraham, and they've received all the benefits, and therefore they are just as Jewish as I am.
They are Israel.
They are Israel, exactly. And it's,
you know, do you realize how confusing that is, what you just said there? I mean, I can tell that it's obvious to you.
Well, do you know anybody who's been adopted into their family?
Yeah.
Were they ever a second-class citizen, or did they ever not receive the inheritance that maybe the rest of the children would have received,
no.
Or were they ever treated different?
Nope.
Of course not. They are absolute members of that family, whether they're adopted or not. And the ethnically non-Jewish people who've come to faith in Jesus have been adopted as Paul writes, they've been grafted into the tree of Abraham, and they receive all the benefits and blessings. And in fact, the Jews who do not believe, and this is where I get into some good arguments with some of my fellow brothers and sisters in the Jewish people, they are the Gentiles.
That must be an interesting moment
when
you make that point.
It's pretty harsh, but the reality is, God has always defined His people as a covenant people who are a people of faith, and so those
the promise
exactly, and so those who do not are cut off and are no longer part of that family, and those who do, whether they're Jewish ethnically or not, come into that family and they become part of that family, and so. You know, I always see the distinction in my head as Jews and Gentiles, believers and unbelievers. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. I have an ethnicity that's Jewish, and therefore, as I tell people, I was cut off. I was withering on the ground at the root of that tree. I was dying, and by God's grace, the great gardener was able to even graft this dying, withering branch back into the tree. But there's a lot of people who are still withering and dying and dead, if you will, at the base of that tree that God desires to also graft. And what's so important is that Paul writes to, I am writing to you Gentiles in so much it is for me, because he's saying, I need you to make them jealous for the relationship that you have with Jesus and with God. So that they can be grafted in. And so Paul makes those distinctions too, for the sake of clarity. But when it comes to faith, there is no distinction.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Rick, you're on the Bible study.
I say amen, and that other word that we're not supposed to use during the Lent season.
All right, we understand.
Yeah.
We respect your restraint.
Okay. I recently bought a new Bible, the American Standard Version. And I was reading in Genesis about God speaking to Abraham about all of his descendants and what was going to be happening to them and that they were going to be going into exile. But as for you, Abram, you will go unto your fathers in peace. Now, where exactly, what was that all about? Being Abraham, the father of many nations.
Yeah, he's sort of the first. He was the first father, so who are his fathers?
Right, because we know that his father, I think he took his father with him, but still he was a pagan. And
that's an interesting question, because we talk about Jacob, and we talk about the patriarchs, but
right.
when we talk about their fathers, that we always stop at Abraham.
Right.
Where do you go after that? Oh, that's a good question. All right, we'll talk about it.
Thank you.
You ever thought about that, Pastor?
Well, I always read that text to imply that is God the Father. When Jewish people talk about our fathers, they're thinking more generically about the resting place of our people, and it's sort of like when the rich man and Lazarus, when Lazarus went to the bosom of Abraham, he was going to his fathers, that's kind of how I've often interpreted that passage, although I'm often wrong. So,
well, if there was a promise, and that's the key, when was the promise first delivered? Is it Genesis 3? To Adam and Eve?
Well, I always go back to 12, to Abraham. What's so fascinating about that is Abraham's promise is that his descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Well, how could you possibly count all the believers who have ever come and gone before and after us? That's pretty numerous and uncountable. You can count the number of Jewish people in the world. So I think that's an amazing approach to this whole issue of Jews versus Gentiles.
But the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky include you includes you, but includes me
sure
too.
It does. That's what I'm saying. I mean, all the believers who
descended from Abraham,
who've ever descended by adoption or by ethnicity, it doesn't matter, by faith. And Hebrews makes it pretty good clear, you know, clear that it's by faith.
But the man Abraham was preceded by the man Noah, was he not?
Mm-hmm.
Was not Noah given promises? Did not Noah believe in those promises and act on those promises?
Certainly, and Abraham and Adam.
Could Noah be father to Father Abraham? Is that a legitimate perspective?
I think that's perhaps a good interpretation.
Could Adam?
Adam and Eve. I mean, certainly they left the garden because of sin, but
faith
they
didn't begin with the first promise to just Abraham, did it?
No, it began in the garden, certainly.
So Father Abraham was three or four innings into the deal, I think, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
Let's take another quick call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Michael, can you be brief?
I was interested in the Bible verse from Acts 3, verse 26. And if I can remember, I don't have my Bible in front of me, but it says something about they were first going to, it seemed like, the Jews by implication. But then I guess after that promise passes over to the Gentiles, and that would include us.
All right, we'll talk about it. We've got about a minute left here. Thanks for the call. Sounds like he's making reference to the fact that it was Paul's practice, it was the early church practice, to go to the synagogues first and then move on to the Gentiles second.
Yeah, and I don't see that as the promise having left the Jews. It's just a fact. I mean, certainly Jewish people, there's always been a remnant of Jewish people who have been a believer in God and his promises through Jesus since Christ's death and resurrection. And there's been more Jewish people having come to faith in Jesus in the last 100 years than in the whole history of the church since then. So I don't think the promise has left the Jews, but it has included the Gentiles. And that's Paul's point, is that all through his ministry, and if he's the preeminent missionary of New Testament times, that's a good model to follow. He was apostle to the Gentiles. In other words, the message of salvation was not just for Jews. He was sent, though Peter was sent to the Jews, Paul was sent to the Gentiles. But Paul never left his mission, too, of taking it first to the Jew as well. And so it's for both. God's intention has always been for his plan of salvation to be for all the nations.
Michael, I hope that answers your question, and that brings us to the end of our program here. Pastor Parviz, thank you so much. God's blessings on your Holy Week.
And thank you. Blessings to you as well.
Pastor Kevin Parviz with us here for our Ask the Pastor program. We continue in the book of Acts on Monday when we resume on what will be Holy Monday. Hope you can join us then.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.